I'm Paige, the host of Reverie True Crime. I tell stories of helpless victims, vicious killers, predators watching their prey before they strike, survivors, petty crimes, people we think we know who do the unthinkable, and the dangers that lurk not only in the dead of night, but in plain sight in the light of day. Every once in a while, I'll also tell stories of the frightening paranormal, elusive cryptids, haunted locations, and conspiracies that may be silly or thought-provoking. You can listen to Reverie True Crime wherever you're listening to this podcast. Feel free to follow me on Twitter at Reverie Crime Pod, Facebook, Instagram, and even Tumblr at Reverie True Crime. Remember, stay safe, be aware of your surroundings at all times, and take care.
Hello and welcome to Happy Horror Time. I'm Tim Murdoch.
And I'm Matt Emmert, and we are here today with the leader of the Monster Squad. He played Sean in the 1987 horror comedy that's gone on to become a cult classic, and then over 30 years later went on to direct an amazing documentary called Wolfman's Got Nards about Monster Squad's incredible impact on audiences. It was just released on demand in the US and Canada last October of 2020. We're so excited to welcome to the podcast Andre Gower.
Hey, that's me.
That's you. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. That was that intro made me sound halfway cool. I'll dig it.
You are cool.
We are fans. We've done our research. We want to make sure, like, we know. I mean, there's a Uh-oh. Ton to go over, but you know, it's funny because before we even jump into all the Monster Squad stuff, everyone knows, you know, that you were a big child actor, but I'd love to know how you first got into the business at such a young age. Like, did you have like I was discovered at a mall moment, or did you just start slowly going on auditions?
You know, really what it was is my sister, Carlina, is a few years older than I am. And she was actually in the business for, you know, as a young tyke as well for many years before I was even, you know, in the universe. And I was just sort of, I don't want to say, I was just next, like I was always around it. And it, I was never not around it, even from a very young age. And so I started when I was 5 and, you know, just kind of went from there. So I don't really have too many years that I wasn't connected or involved in this industry in some way. I was in it and then out of it and then in it and then out of it. But yeah, my sister Carlina was the reason, I guess, that the world has to deal with me and all of my stuff now. So it's, and she did quite a bit, you know, in the 70s and into the early 80s. And her kind of, you know, biggest credit, you know, so to speak, she was the little girl in the huge disaster movie, The Towering Inferno.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, wow.
That's cool. So you are definitely on our radar with all your sitcoms. You were on the 80s TV shows, The A-Team, Knight Rider, My Two Dads, Mr. Belvedere. I was just wondering if you had any stories or favorites, or like, do you like being in front of a studio audience, or?
Yeah, which are your favorites among all those 80s shows to film?
God, I don't know if there's a favorite. You know, the first question, like, you know, is there a preference on those styles? I just think they're all sort of a unique experience. You know, look, I mean, you mentioned the A-Team. I got to go up into the mountains and I was a lumberjack. So we got to chop down trees with Mr. T. I mean, who gets to do that? But, you know, you mentioned, you know, with kind of that formulaic, awesome, you know, 80s sitcoms, which we don't have too many of the live studio audience ones.
Definitely not now. Yeah. Digital audience, virtual.
I mean, despite, you know, not even despite of or in spite of, you know, COVID times, there's not a lot of live audience, 3-camera. Video sitcoms, doing a sitcom in front of a live audience is a whole other thing. It's sort of like doing theater because you have this instant reaction and you can feel, you know, there's 100 and 150 people, you know, about 20 yards away from you. you know, that's how it's all set up, you know, to elicit that live reaction. And it's definitely a thing.
David Hasselhoff was your favorite Knight Rider.
So what you're saying is what you're saying is Knight Rider all the way.
Knight Rider all the way. You know, yeah, sure, why not? Knight Rider was most of my scenes in that episode. I was sort of the B plot. I wasn't even the main plot of the episode, and I was this kind of kid who rides by on a skateboard and Kit starts talking to, and I'm like, you know, not interested in going to school. And all of a sudden I jump in the car and he shows me on his video screen, like, you know, how cool science is. You know, I got to work with Hasselhoff, you know, a little in the middle and then at the last scene, because it tied in with the A plot, I guess, because the person that Hasselhoff and was helping, or Michael Knight was helping, was a teacher. And oh, look how it works out. She happens to be my teacher. So it was, it all came to pass there. But, you know, that's a whole other thing, working, you know, with a car.
Oh my God. Yeah.
You know, well, as your kind of, you know, scene partner.
Speaking of your television performances, as being horror fanatics and looking into your background a little more, we were really excited to discover that at the end of 1985, you starred alongside Piper Laurie, you know, as in Margaret White from the original Carrie, in an episode of the Twilight Zone revival called The Burning Man. So I have to ask you, what was Piper Laurie like to work with? Did you have any idea of, like, her career at that age?
So I think I was 10.
So you knew everything about her.
No, yeah. I had known quite a bit, but I show up, you know, I audition and I get cast in this episode of, you know, the new Twilight Zone series. And I know that it's a, you know, a teleplay based off of a Ray Bradbury short story. Mm-hmm. And I kind of knew who Ray Bradbury was. And I show up to set and there's these two, you know, adult actors, older adult actors. And I knew that something was special about both of them. I just didn't know them personally. And I had no idea really who they were. And I recognized the guy, and the guy happened to be Robert's Blossom
from Home Alone.
Yeah.
From everything.
I know. It's like,
I feel like people know him obviously as the scary neighbor in Home Alone, but of course he had a huge, huge career. Yeah. But yes, go on.
So you instantly recognize, you know, kind of faces like that. And just, you can tell when you're around like real actors, like people that know what they're doing and have done it for a long time. There's a presence and there's kind of like a gravity. And, you know, it was interesting to learn later who Piper Laurie was, because I had to work an entire week with, you know, Piper Laurie, who, you know, I eventually learned, you know, later in the day, is like, oh, she's been around for, she's done some quite amazing stuff. And, you know, then you go rent, you know, to the VHS store and rent like The Hustler and care, you know, you can see things like that. And she was a delight. I mean, super sort of, I don't want to say, it certainly was not out of her element. I remember shooting that scene because it takes place like in the 30s, and yeah, we were way north of LA, and it was blazing hot. It's in the summer and it's supposed to be like the hottest summer on record in Kansas, I think is what the story was. And it was this interesting short story about, you know, we're driving off to go into this lake because it's so hot. And like my aunt is taking me to like cool off in the lake. And we're telling stories and singing songs, I think. And we see this little kid in the middle of nowhere, middle of the road. And we pick him up. And it happened to be Danny Cooksey that they cast in this role. He's wearing like this white suit. And it looks like he, you know, got lost or fell off the back of someone's truck or something. And he's like, well, get in the car. You gotta, you know, come with us and we'll help you out. And, there's this story, like he starts getting creepy. And no, I'm sorry. We don't see Danny Cooksey yet. Sorry. We see Robert's Blossom. Sorry. And it's like this old guy in the middle of nowhere. And we pick him up and he's all disheveled, like he fell off a truck. And he starts saying all these creepy things like, you know, if there could be 75 year locusts, why can't there be 75 year people?
Totally normal.
in a pod underground. And then they come out and, you know, scavenge humans and then go back into the ground and lay their eggs for the next 75 years. We thought he was crazy and we kick him out of the car. We go to the lake, we splash around. And that was one area, I think Piper Laurie, the only time she was uncomfortable, like we had to dive in this lake, which is out in this like movie ranch north of LA. And like, no one likes to dive in unfamiliar pond water. And then as the characters come back in the meeting, we find this kid. And what had happened is Robert's Blossom is the 75-year-old Pod who had split open, and out comes Danny Cooksey, and our car breaks down and he eats us.
Yeah, it's a lovely, uplifting story. Yeah. No, we watch it. It ends and it's just like, because we found it. And it ends and it's like just, like, I think Danny Cooksey is like saying something and you realize it's him, and then you guys are just like in, or you turn and you just like looked really creeped out, and it's like end credits.
Just that slow kind of turn, end of story, fade to black, and we know we're dead.
Well, I know. Well, it's a totally cool, and again, like I said, for horror fanatics like us, it's just like, I was like, oh my god,
Twilight Zone.
Piper Laurie. Well, Twilight Zone, yes, too, but I mean, Piper Laurie, of course, is an icon, but...
Well, for a couple of horror tie-ins to that episode, it's kind of neat because there's kind of two neat ones. The guy that directed that episode, it's the first time he ever directed anything, especially as a big network show, and his name is J.D. Fiegelson, and he was a TV writer for years. And then shortly after that episode, he wrote a kind of, you know, half-known, I don't want to say cult status, but kind of definitely niche fan-based horror movie called Night of the Scarecrow. With Larry Drake, wrote and directed Dr. that
Giggles.
Movie. And then the DP of that episode was a guy named Bradford May, who had been working for a long time. And he was the DP on Monster Squad.
Oh, small world.
I know. Wow. There's always tons of crazy connection, which we love. But, you know, moving on to Monster Squad. So I actually didn't know this until watching Wolfman Scott Nard's, which we'll, of course we'll get to later, but that you actually screen tested for the role of Rudy first, the cool kid. So I just wanted to ask you, can you tell, what was the audition process like? And do you have any regrets of getting the role of Sean versus Rudy?
only at the very beginning. You know, like the first hour that they call and tell you. Yeah, regular kind of audition process. You know, the breakdowns come through, your agent submits you, or, you know, you get requested to come in and audition. And up until kind of, you know, the fall, summer, early fall of 86, I had done a bunch of television, obviously, like we were talking about. And some of that was, you know, the cool kid with a lot of hair product and, you know, dresses neat and maybe a leather jacket or two. And so I automatically got submitted and, you know, I got requested to read for the role of Rudy. And I went through that entire process. And so it was, you know, the initial audition, the callback, the second callback, and go back, you know, 3, 4, 5, half a dozen times. And you wait a couple of weeks because this is a daily occurrence, you know, at this time. It's like, it's, you know, if you're not reading for one thing every day, you're reading for 3 to 4. And it's that's just how it is. Everybody reads for everything, especially if you happen to be fortunate enough to be, you know, kind of on the list that gets those auditions. And I was at the time, which was...
Oh, can I ask a question? Who else was on this list? I mean, you can name drop. It's just us.
Of the audition list for Monster Squad?
I mean, we're just your like, who your main competition was.
Well, at that time, you know, if you're really kind of drilling down, I mean, just go back from, you know, 83 to 90 and take everybody that looks like us, you know, for that kind of, you know, look. You know, I mean, it's every, you know, you pick like a 3 year, like 13 to 16 year olds, and we're all reading for the same stuff. So, you know, at that time, you know, it's all great people like, you know, me, Stephen Dorff, Bobby Jacoby, Jason Hervey, you know, Ryan Lambert up to that point. You know, it's a big list. And, you know, a lot of them are on TV shows at the time. A lot of them, you know, were bouncing around. We're doing all the other work and films and getting our own shows. Just go look at all the teen magazines from 87, 88, 89. It's all them.
I had the, I don't know which magazine it was, but there was pictures of you guys in a limo going to the Monster Squad premiere. I remember coming out of Jaws 4 and seeing the Monster Squad poster. I was so excited.
It's Bop and teen, all of
yes,
that.
I had
well, them. But so when you were saying about the audition process, and then how did you find out that you'd got a different role than you had been reading?
Yeah, you know, a couple of weeks later, they call and say, hey, that movie you read for, you actually got cast in it, and you celebrate. And they go, but not the role that you read for. And that's usually bad news. Like, you know, kind of historically, if that happens to an actor, They liked you, but someone else is better for them. They find a smaller role, or, you know, maybe a 1 or 2 days or something. And, you know, you get a little deflated. And they said, no. They cast you as the lead, like just straight out. And I was like, no, Rudy's the cool kid. He kills more monsters. He gets to shoot the stuff, the gun and the bow. He gets the girl at the end. Like, this is the cool character. And so that's always been kind of the running joke with Ryan Lambert and myself. But it was, and now, you know, over the last couple of years, especially, you know, making the documentary and then talking about the impact of the documentary just with fans and the characters, and how that movie that didn't do well in 87 has impacted not only fans, but the people that were also in it and made it. You know, it's a very interesting kind of perspective and introspective on my part to realize that on some random day in August or September of 86, when they're sitting around and again, reading everybody in town for all these roles, especially Sean. So, you know, it's the Astons, it's the Coreys, it's, you know, the everything for every bit, right? Mm-hmm. And someone, I still don't know who it was, whether it was Fred or Penny Perry or, you know, Peter Himes, you know, one of the producers, or just some random assistant, you know, when they're trying to fill out the cast and casting the lead at the end, somebody said, hey, what about that kid that we read for Rudy that we liked, maybe, but didn't get it because Ryan Lambert came, because I know why I didn't get Rudy, because I've played Rudy. Yes, it would have been a more laid back, kind of cheesy Rudy, but Ryan Lambert came in and murdered his auditions and became Rudy in that instant, right?
He's the definition of cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know exactly what happened in the room and all, you know, when that happened, because, you know, we've all talked about it for years. But somebody in, you know, in that group said, what if that kid Andre is Sean? Should we read him? Should we call him back in? And usually he would come back in and read for that role, or read some of the words that are going to come out of that person's mouth off the page. And that didn't happen. They just straight cast me as the role. And we went and shot the movie, which, you know, thankfully someone mentioned my name, you know, and remembered my Rudy auditions. And, you know, as they say, the rest is history. But, you know, I'm very fortunate that that actually happened. I know Ryan came in, nailed his audition, and, you know, everybody else read for the roles that they got except for me. And so I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
I mean, it means that they trusted you enough, or at least in your capabilities, that it's like they could see you in that role. And like you said, didn't even need to have you come down and read as that role. And considering that's the lead, that's pretty awesome. You know,
were you a fan of horror films prior? Or, I mean, did you have a favorite horror film or Universal Monster?
I enjoyed horror, enjoyed genre, you know, and this was what, you know, 86, 87 at the time. So we had our new horror. So like we had the, you know, kind of the 80s slasher flicks. And obviously we had Jason and Freddy, and Freddy, I think, is the most terrifying monster we have.
Oh, don't forget Michael Myers.
Okay. You can have, he's creepy too. Boy, the end of Halloween too. You know, when Pleasance says, you know, Michael, it's time to die. That freaked me out as a kid. But I enjoyed the old movies. Like I liked old movies. I remember watching, you know, there's a few, you know, horror movies that you shouldn't see, you know, at a certain young age. And of course I started with Wizard of Oz, which is absolutely a horror movie. But
The Witch is terrified me as a kid. Really?
They're all terrifying. Yeah. And please still don't bring a flying monkey around me, because I will run the other way. But you know, like The Exorcist, and I saw the original I Spit on Your Grave way too early. I don't know if it's a horror movie. It's more of like a revenge flick. That was very unsettling as like a 10-year-old or 12, whatever, you see that. But I was a TV nut. So I watched a ton of television. And of course, starting in TV and film, when you're 5, you're interested in all this stuff. And, you know, I'd watch, you know, late night, Friday nights, you know, syndication channels, and, you know, all day Saturday. So you wake up, you watch cartoons, then you go play, and then you cut, because you're not watching sports yet. So in the middle of the day, you know, you're out playing, and then you come back in and you watch Kung Fu Theater, and you watch old horror movies or old classic movies. And so I saw a ton of stuff, you know, as a kid. And Creature from the Black Lagoon was always my favorite guy. So he's my creature. He's my monster.
In 3D.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Not on my little shitty black and white TV, but yes.
So, you know, the director of Monster Squad, Fred Decker, also wrote and directed another one of our favorite horror comedies from the 80s, Night of the Creeps. Yeah. I was wondering, what was his directing style like, especially working with so many young kids? Any memorable moments from working with him?
Well, I think, you know, the whole experience is one memorable moment, but, you know, especially dealing with Fred. And I think that some of the dynamic that has, you know, stood the test of time, that doesn't kind of get old when you're watching these characters, the kids as characters in this movie, starting with the words on the page that Fred and Shane wrote, and then Fred having to sort of be that person that you're kind of, you know, buoy in the sea, and, you know, your guidepost of, you know, where you're supposed to be and what you're supposed to be doing and how you're supposed to be thinking, you know, because it's 3.5 months every day, you know, shooting a movie out of sequence, and you've got to make it make sense. And, you know, that counts with characters and performances. I think the thing that made a difference was, one, starting with the script and the subject matter and the words and the dialogue that the characters were going back and forth with helped, because Fred and Shane were not that much older than we were. I mean, they were like 10 years older than we were. And, you know, normally when you're looking at some, maybe a kid's adventure comedy, quote unquote, in the 80s, it's usually written by some 45-year-old dude that hasn't been a 13-year-old in decades. And, you know, is typing away going, oh, I remember when I was a kid, they used to say this and this was funny. Let's see, let's put it in this kid's mouth and make it, oh, it's campy. Great. Campy's fun. And it doesn't work sometimes, you know, because it seems forced and it seems unoriginal. And mm-hmm. I think Fred and Shane, being kids at heart and not much older technically than Ryan and I, who are the oldest on the set, you know, kind of translated and came across. But on the set with Fred, I remember him being, you know, our figure that we looked towards for guidance and connection to this whole big thing that was going on. But he also knew to interact with us, you know, sort of on our level, and, you know, got down to eye level, literally and figuratively with us. And then, you know, kind of allowed us to be us, but also pointed us in the direction and put us in a, you know, kind of a mold of where we needed to be on an ongoing process. And, you know, that's a hard thing to do, to work with kids. And this is Fred's second movie. You know, he just made Creeps, you know, the year before, you know, with some success, not much box office success, but with some success to get your next movie greenlit. And then now we have a whole cast of kids for different ages, which is a whole other headache. And then special effects and monster effects, animals and, you know, things like that.
It's not CGI, so I'm sure it took much longer time.
Yeah. Much longer, you know, it was right at that transition time where, you know, the visual effects were getting a little, you know, digital, a little computer generated. And, you know, it was literally the mix of all three of the styles, where you had practical creature effects. You had some special visual effects that were computer and art animation driven. And, you know, and then also, you know, even old effects like matte paintings, you know, as backdrops. And, you know, mixed. So we had a matte painting, and normally if you have this huge backdrop as a matte painting, it's static and it doesn't move. But in Monster Squad, we have a matte painting, you know, which is this giant, you know, awesome drive-in theater behind my house, but the movie is actually playing on the screen. So that's not new technology, but it's done well, so it doesn't look old and it looks, you know, halfway believable. And, you know, late 80s, early 90s was right when all that was kind of the transition was happening. And it all came together. And I think, look, the guy that did the visual effects on Monster Squad did a couple of movies, you know, called Star Wars. You know, it's good for, you know, Richard Edlund knows what he's doing when he's making little, you know, lightning bolts and stuff. It was very interesting. And then Stan Winston's guys making the creature effects was all, you know, an absolute paradigm shift, you know, into the modern era of how you build creatures and make them work.
Well, and one thing I wanted to touch on that you kind of mentioned when you were talking about the script, and I just have to gush for a second about why I love this movie so much. It's because I think why I love it, it's for me, it's the epitome of what made the 80s like so great. You know, the writing's amazing. The kids actually act and sound like kids, you know, like the lines that are written, they just sound normally like kids. All the references, from your t-shirt with the Stephen King rules to the horror movie that you guys are watching called Groundhog Day Part 12, you know, like even the big music montage in the middle, it's just like so 80s. But all in all, like the performances, I feel like really make this movie great. great. And that is, you know, you and the other kids and the director really make this movie so relatable and I think and just fun to watch, you know. And so that's a huge kudos to you and, you know, and the cast and the director. But I think it just felt natural and relatable. And that's why I think it resonated so much with people.
I agree wholly. And I think, you know, over the last few years, I have narrowed it down to, you know, two words of why that script works, you know, and why the performances come out in the way that they do. And I think it's because the whole thing has heart and authenticity.
Yeah.
And it comes across that way when you actually pay attention to it. That, you know, everybody was in the right spot. And I think that's what happens when movies, you know, hit the mark.
So obviously we know that you still keep in contact with Rudy and the young girl, but yes. With all the cast members, like, did you guys like get along the entire time?
Yeah. Well, especially while you were filming, cause I know you caught up with a lot, but did you become close while on the set? Like when you guys were all kids, cause I know you were all different ages, but did you become close, like a close knit group?
You do obviously for those 3 months you're together every day doing, you know, this crazy stuff. But I hadn't known anybody else in the cast, except for Robbie Kiger, who played Patrick, and we had actually known each other basically our whole lives. And so we were comfortable with each other and, you know, had been friends, you know, for years. It's weird to say, you know, we've been friends for years and we're 13. And, but Ryan and I had literally met like the month before we started shooting, and cause he was fairly new. He had come in. His first audition that he ever went to, he went to an open call for Kids Incorporated the year or two prior and got it and had done that and then did Monster Squad. And I met him at a party like a month or 3 weeks before we started shooting. You know, we became friendly and then we were with each other, you know, for three months straight. And we were friends for years, just like everybody else. Ashley Bank, who played Phoebe, and Michael Faustino, who played Eugene, were obviously, you know, 5 and 6 years old, I think. I was actually friends with Michael's brother, David Faustino.
Wasn't David Faustino on Married with Children?
The name Faustino.
Correct.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. Exactly. So David, you know, had been around for a while and then, you know, got married with children in 88 or 89. You know, we all, you know, after you shoot the movie, you're all friends because you go through this process and you're, you know, attached to each other forever. And, you know, they all come to birthday parties and you go to, you know, they come to my birthday parties. They go to their birthday parties.
And someone just celebrated a birthday. Someone just turned 50.
Ryan did. He just turned 50 the other day. So.
Wow.
Yeah. Happy birthday, Ryan. You old fart.
You old fart. Wow. I know we're talking about, you know, when you guys are like 13, 15 now he's 50, everyone. Way to feel old.
I mean, I'll be 44.
I mean,
yeah, you know, 50's different. I'm 2 years away, but, yeah, you know, I celebrated by, you know, because we also hadn't seen each other mostly, throughout the 90s. And most of the, you know, into the 2006 when we did the first cast reunion screening. And then Ashley, Ryan, and Fred and myself went to the Alamo Draft House. And that's what that screening weekend on Easter, ironically, so it was 15 years ago this weekend, was what started this whole resurgence with Monster Squad, you know, fandom and the culture around that. And, you know, ever since then, you know, we'd all been tight again, you know, especially me, Ashley, and Ryan. And you know, going to conventions and going to appearances and screenings and comic cons and things like that, and getting to reconnect with Fred and Shane. And then Ryan and I, you know, got close again because we had both moved back to LA at the same time back in like 2014. And we started working on projects and we had a podcast of our own. And I had developed a couple projects for us. He was working on developing some concepts that, you know, we were out there trying to, you know, pitch around town. And one of them, I created a show where Ryan and I were co-hosts called Short Ends, which Nerdist and Legendary Studios bought to put on their digital channel. And we did 22 episodes of that. And it was Ryan and I co-hosted it. It was an interview show. It was a showcase show about filmmakers and short films. And then Ryan and I got to goof off and be us, you know, in between. And that was a fun experience. And because Ryan and I work really well together, even though we're completely different, were very similar. And, you know, once we reconnected back in 2014-ish, it just kind of, you know, dropped in the slot. It was crazy.
So this is my absolute favorite question going back. Like, what do you remember? Like, obviously the Alamo was fairly recently, but do you remember the very first premiere of the movie?
Yeah, like, was there any sort
like
of
a red carpet or
cast and crew screening, like just for you guys,
when it first
came out?
I think, I mean, you get to see some scenes when you do, you know, kind of, you know, ADR and looping type stuff to replace some dialogue or sound, you know, months before it comes out. I can't remember if we saw, I don't think we saw a cast screening. I think we went to the main premiere, which was in Westwood. And after that, the studio had they had a big premiere party at the Hard Rock Cafe. Nice. And, you know, they had actors dress up in the monster suits. It didn't look anything like the characters, but, you know, that was a weird kind of idea. But like, it was Schwarzenegger was there and like Michael Douglas was there, and there's all these huge names were at the Hard Rock Cafe because it was a big studio PR type of thing, like show up at this party and hang out for a little bit. And there was a ton of kids there, a lot of kid actors as well. And then Ryan and I, like 2 weeks later, we flew to New York for the same party at the New York Hard Rock Cafe. And nobody else went to that. It was just Ryan and I. And like George Segal was there, ironically, you know, he just died, which sucks. And like Margot Kidder was there. I remember I met Lois Lane. I was like, oh my God, this is Lois Lane. This is crazy.
And we love her from Black Christmas.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. And wow. I'm sitting there going, this is cool that we're flying all over the country and having, you know, premiere parties at the Hard Rock Cafe, which used to be cool. You know, the Hard Rock Cafe used to be cool.
You know, I know we were talking about it. We're slowly getting toward Wolf and Scott and Arts and the documentary. But what I wanted to know is because you mentioned the Alamo Drafthouse screening, and that was at the 20th anniversary. But until that 20th anniversary reunion screening, had you given Monster Squad much thought or like meaning through
was
those?
Was it on your radar?
Yeah, because like for we always, you know, you've talked about in the documentary, it's like all the fandom was kind of discovered starting then. So in those first 20 years, was it kind of like, oh, it was just a movie I did and you didn't really think much of it?
Yes, for the most part. You know, for us, we realized that the fandom was there after that Alamo event blew up in 2006. And we said, no idea. But that doesn't happen, you know, kind of that, you know, it was really almost an atomic reaction after that weekend, because now we had the internet, people could connect, they learned about this event, and now it goes crazy. But that doesn't happen from scratch. What that means is these fans had been around for 20 years. They just didn't have any real, you know, gravity center to connect to or each other to connect with. It was pre-internet, you know, but people were, you know, chat rooms around for, you know, 5, 6, 10 years. And it was just sort of out there in the ether. And then that Alamo event was really sort of, you know, kind of a gravity event where all that kind of detritus kind of came together and then went supernova and exploded, you know, not to get nerdy and scientific, but, you know, anybody that, you know, took astronomy will get that.
No, but I know what you're saying. It's a good metaphor because it's like then right after that, isn't that that's when like the DVD came out and the special features and like everything. And then there were more screenings and everything. So you think it kind of because, yeah, you're right. It's not like the fandom just suddenly came to be at that screening and it existed. And that's where it was able to, I guess, come to life in a way, you know,
it did. They finally had a rallying point, really. And, you know, the internet happened and, you know, they were there for 20 years or, you know, 19, 18 years, whether they saw it on HBO or, you know, at their video store, you know, the next year. But they were in their neighborhoods. They were stuck, you know, at home. They passed it around to their friends in the cul-de-sac or on the schoolyard. And then everybody grows up and it kind of lays dormant for a while. It's certainly an interesting dynamic of that timeline. Of the fandom of how, because they could have very easily said, we're never going to see or hear about this movie again. So I'm just going to forget about it. And the fans did not do that. And, you know, to see that explosion in 2006, you know, to less, you know, almost a year later, all of a sudden a major studio putting out the 20th anniversary DVD, which goes bonkers. And then we're headlining conventions and we're going all over the place and doing these screenings. And that's what led to, you know, realizing that this kind of fan connection to this movie and our connection to that dynamic as the cast was very unique. And I started kind of asking questions about that, you know, outwardly and inwardly, and, you know, seeing these events and seeing other films and other fandoms and fan culture, I realized ours was unique in its own way. And that's really sort of what the spark of the documentary was.
Well, that's actually, you're getting right to what my next question was, which was basically regarding, so, I mean, moving on to Wolfman's Gotten Arts, which I just have to say, I definitely recommend for anybody listening who's a fan of Monster Squad or even just a fan of 80s movies. It's such a heartfelt documentary. Like, it just happens to have, I think it's at 100% score on Rotten Tomatoes, which is amazing. But that's what I was going to ask. I wanted to see how the documentary came to be, but it's sounding like, I think you kind of explained that, like when you came up with the idea or how it all came together, how long it took you to do the interviews, but it's sounding like this whole fandom is what really sparked it in your mind.
That's what sparked the concept of something, right? Mm-hmm. Not really our end result, but it was just sort of, it was looking at and then going to the next event and seeing that this kind of, you know, fan wave of, you know, we thought it was just a quick nostalgic thing that would, you know, flare out like a, you know, a firework or something. And it did not only did never peter out, it only got stronger. And the foundation got deeper. And so this upward trajectory just kept going solid. You know, usually time just goes straight up and then falls down and it's over. This thing just kept, you know, sort of at this, you know, kind of takeoff trajectory. And that lift underneath it just got stronger because the fans kept coming in and shoring it up and demanding more and being more present and more vocal and more social about it. And that's when I realized that for some reason, like all the things we were talking about, the story, the characters, the dialogue of Monster Squad, the theme, the tones, you know, what it dealt with, really connected with the fans of this movie some way, shape, or form. And I, as an individual, was interested in interrogating that a little bit. Like, why is this different than other, like we're at a convention and there's, you know, Barry Bostwick or Bruce Campbell, and everybody loves these people from these, you know, famous genre stuff. But that this fandom with Monster Squad fans is just different for some reason. And I tried to remove myself from that inside perspective, just thinking it was, you know, either a selfish kind of view or, and I realized that it wasn't, because I started asking people and sitting down with them and realizing time and time again, when these fans would come up and meet you, this meant something.
Yeah.
And to realize that these people were impacted, you know, whether they were young girls or young boys at the time or college students or film students, whenever they saw the movie for the first time, it made an impact. It connected with them and they never let go. And I thought that was interesting enough to look at. And, you know, fast forward past my original ideas of what I thought a documentary could be, because I had, you know, my original notion was, hey, we're coming up on the 30th anniversary. You know, Ryan and Ashley and I, you know, we're going to be going around, you know, doing a bunch of big events this year. Let's go get a camera and we'll do some like crazy, you know, fan on the street type BS and come back and have one of our friends edit it together. Like we'll buy him a beer or something and like, you know, put together like a 30-minute, you know, doc, and we'll put it on our website, because we had a podcast at the time. And I tried that at one event and it just didn't work. It wasn't what it should have been. I had a very serendipitous lunch appointment with an old friend of mine who worked at a place called Pilgrim Media Group. And I pulled up in front of the building, called her and said, let's go to lunch. She's like, all right. And because we got out of the car to meet someone that was unloading a truck in the parking lot who happened to be a Monster Squad fan that worked in the building, I said, let's get out and say hello. And we said hello to this guy named Andrew, who ended up working on the doc and is an awesome person. Because of that little 30-second delay, three other guys came out of the building and walked down the sidewalk and ran into us. And it was Wes Caldwell, Aaron Kunkel, and Henry McComas, who ended up being the three main production guys on the documentary. And we met, I explained what we're doing, and we went to lunch like a couple days later. And Henry said, look, if you're working on a documentary, I said, I'm not actually. That kind of took the back burner. I just sold two other shows that I'm really working on right now. And he says, well, I think this is something that we could do here and I really want to do it. Let's meet and take it to the executives and pitch them the idea. So let's work on that. And we did. And a very short time later, we were greenlit. I worked out a deal with Pilgrim and my company to make this movie, and we went into production a few weeks later. You know, Tim, like you said, we even at that time, I didn't know everything that was going to happen in the next 10 or 12 months because it was a 30th anniversary year. Some of that stuff is, you know, made last minute. Some of it's made 6 months in advance. And they got very fortunate by the Alamo, who, you know, still friends with even to this day back then. And they called me and said, hey, we want to do a 30th anniversary tour. Do you think you'd be interested in going around? Because they do cool stuff like that with other films. And I was like, wow, what do you think it's going to be? And they're like, well, we're thinking like a dozen or 15 dates. And if you want to go, like, we'll fly, we'll take you around and just go to location to location. And I was like, that sounds crazy. Are you interested in having anybody else? And they said, well, if anybody else wants to go, let's talk about it. And I got Ryan and Ashley on board, and I knew I had we were in production at that time. And so not only did we go to 17 cities in 17 days, we had Ryan and Ashley and Ashley's baby, who was 16 months old at the time. Wow. And so we had to bring her the entire 3 weeks, and it was awesome. But I also had a production crew, in front of us and behind us and traveling in parallel the whole time, because we were trying to shoot a documentary, and this 17 city, 17 day tour, had no idea how important it would have been as a through line to the actual finished product of the documentary. It really helped, having that continuous kind of thing to go back to during the documentary narrative. And we got some of our best stuff that we didn't script or didn't plan on the road, meeting some of the fans or getting some of the, kind of B-roll and things like that. It was just one of those things on a list of like a dozen that happened in the 10 or 11 months we were actually shooting.
Did you watch the movie every night? I mean, like,
yeah, because I know in the documentary it said there's like sometimes two screenings a day. Did you literally watch it every single time?
No. So the what happens on a tour like that is, and like I said, 17 cities in 17 days sounds arduous enough, but you have to now remember that over half of those locations did two screenings a night. Oh. So you're really doing 25 or 26 shows in 17 days. And so you go in, you do an intro, say hi to everybody. They play the movie. You come back, you do a Q&A for, 20 to 45 minutes or whatever it is. And then you go out in the lobby and you sign stuff and you take pictures with everybody who wants to stay. And that's usually about 90% of the people that showed up. Yeah. And so you're not getting done until midnight every night. But if you have one of those events, which was 50% of them that had two, you do the Q&A or you do the intro to one, the movie starts in that theater, you bop over to the next theater, you do the intro to that one. As the movie ends, you come and do the Q&A in theater one, and then you wait while that's done, you bop over and do the Q&A in theater two, and then everybody goes out in the lobby and waits for you to come out and sign and take photos. So it was an incredible, 3 weeks of time. But yeah, I think on day nine is where you had to be like, okay, what city are we in? Like, where are we? But what's cool about Ashley and Ryan, they were troopers on that because they didn't have to go on that tour. I put it together and they were troopers enough to also have our cameras in their face the whole time. And then also traveling and doing some extra stuff that, on a random Wednesday morning, they probably wouldn't have been doing.
Yeah. So, and speaking of them, obviously we noticed that of the original Monster Squad members, you, Ryan Lambert, Ashley Bank attended all of these screenings, did the tour and everything. And sadly, I know that Brant Shalom, am I pronouncing his last name correct?
Shalom.
Yeah. And it was tragically passed away in 1997. But we were wondering what happened to Robbie Kiger, who played Patrick, and Michael Faustino, who played Eugene. We were thinking they'd maybe be in the documentary or had attended the, did you lose touch with them or are they just?
Mainly lost touch with Robbie over the years. And then, years later, you find out he had lived in Hawaii for a long time and then had moved around a little bit. And so not a lot of people had contact with him. So, tried to reach out a little bit on social media at a time, knew someone that knew him. And then, if any of the, people that, putting on the events, couldn't get a hold of him. And then we were making the documentary, we reached out and, we just didn't know where he was and had no real contact, so to speak. So you sort of misses out. Michael has, obviously you know, grown up. He's not six anymore. And he's got a family of his own, and he got out of the business very early. Like, he stopped acting, I think, when he was 13 or something. And, you know, when a lot of everybody was just starting, and, you know, just went to school, grew up, and he's actually still in the industry, but he's a high level sound engineer guy. So he does sound for big live shows like The Voice and American Idol and stuff. So, and he's also not, I don't want to say not interested, because he's always followed along and cheered us on. It's just not his bailiwick of, you know, getting back out in front of cameras or, you know, interacting with that. And we're just like, hey, anytime you want to come into these things, you know, pop in, let us know. You know, we'd love to see you. But, you know, everybody has their own path and their own access and their own, you know, desire, you know, to do that type of stuff. And I still haven't seen Michael in a while, but we correspond and email or, you know, Facebook each other every once in a while or send an old photo back and forth.
Well, I'm putting this out in the universe right now for the 40th anniversary screening. Robbie and Michael will be there. It's going to be a full cast. You know, who knows? You know, it's funny. You know, who knows what'll happen? And I'm sure there'll be many other screenings.
In your backyard? Is that what you're saying? You're like, we're going to do the official 40th.
I want to host the 40th anniversary screening and get the whole cast together. You know, we have a couple questions. A couple more questions that we wanted to ask you.
Yeah, I'm good. Fire away. I'm not on a time thing.
Cool. No, awesome. Thank you. I really appreciate it. One is from someone who has quickly become a good friend of ours, a supporter of our podcast. His name is Pete, and he runs the Totally 80s Room Instagram page, which is an amazing Instagram page.
I love it.
So much nostalgia. It's just great and great. And he wanted us to ask you, why, in your opinion, do you think 80s horror movies or Monster Squad in particular are still so relevant today? Like, what would you say is their legacy?
Well, it has to do with age and, you know, when we're born that we, you know, we experience these things for the first time. That's any generation. You have that moment in time that is, that affects your life in some way, shape or form. But the 80s are really a 10-year span that really sets apart from any other decade, honestly. You know, the 50s were paradigm shifting. The 60s were paradigm shifting. The 70s were kind of there, but they had their own paradigm shift. The 80s was a confluence of everything that created our modern time now, you know, from, you know, media to music, to film and TV, to music, especially world politics, you know, things that were going, so much stuff went on there. And it was the first effects of burgeoning technology that was going to be a game changer. Right. And that all kind of swells into mass communication. And we all, you know, started beginning so much information. But art of the time, where there's music, but if we're talking about genre films or TV of the 80s in particular, I think it was a time of just unencumbered creativity because of all those things I mentioned. You know, the world, you know, there's a lot of things going on that you could write about. Most art, be it TV or film or music, and especially look at the 80s, it's all social commentary of all the things that are affecting you at that time, whether you're writing something. And genre has always been a commentary on what's going on socially or politically. Even if you go back to the 1950s creature features or, you know, like Them, or, you know, look at Godzilla and look at Them. And, you know, these are all Cold War, you know, atomic age, frightening stories. They're campy and weird when we see them in the 70s or 80s. But in the 50s, they were terrifying because it was like, oh my God, can radiation make a lizard come out of the water and destroy Tokyo? And so I think, you know, genres has always been sort of that, artistic representation and physical manifestation of our fears of whatever our generation is. Even if you go back to the classic Universal monsters of the 30s and 40s, those were all physical manifestations. Some were off of literature, yes. But even the literature stories were based off of fears coming out of the turn of the century and the Great Depression and World War I and things like that. So monsters and creatures just became the physical manifestation of what we were scared of in our own minds. And the 80s had so much modern stuff to deal with, and it was a paradigm shift. So there was so much more going on. And it was just such a time of an explosion of creativity.
Yeah. No, it really, I mean, and you can see some of that creativity from the 80s on his page. It's absolutely crazy. I mean, if And it is. It's just such a, and you have to really, I feel like you have to have been a lot, well, you don't have to have been alive in it to really appreciate, but I feel like you appreciate it more if you either lived through it or were a kid through it or just experienced it in some way like that. Real quick, I also want to give a shout out to Grace Chan, who actually helped connect us to Andre. She's actually featured in Wolfman's Got Nards because she created a Monster Squad themed zine called I Heart Rudy. She told us she worked from a treasure trove of Andre's Monster Squad memorabilia, his wardrobe, original scripts, exclusive photos, posters, props. It's all documented in the zine, along with exclusive interviews with Andre himself, Ryan Lambert, and Lisa Fuller, who played Patrick's sister. So I just want to tell anybody listening, you can check out, if you check out the at iHeartRudy Instagram page, you can learn more. There's two issues. Both look really cool, and you can purchase them via the link on the bio on that page or through Big Cartel. It's the at iHeartRudy page. So just wanted to give that shout out real quick. You know, I wanted to say, I know you've talked about being on a lot of, going to conventions, going to shows and everything, and what would you say is the most either memorable or, I guess, moving thing that a fan has said to you at a reunion screening or an event? It could be either, I guess, really moving or memorable because it's maybe creepy or just something that really stuck with you.
Oh, man, a good question. Oh, damn, I should be prepared for stuff like that. You know, It happened one time very early in one of the first screening events I ever went to, but I got asked to come to and officiate someone's wedding.
Really?
And I said, hey, if you work it out and fly me there, I'll do it. It never happened. I think they got married, but I didn't go to their wedding. But I made friends that put on that event, and I've been friends with those guys for years. You know, honestly, what it is there's a handful of people that I've met because we've met at events or screenings or conventions that, you know, I've actually become like, you know, friends with, you know, because we see them on a regular basis, or you just, you know, related to, you know, you had some shared experiences or you knew, you know, some of the same people. So that's always kind of interesting. And we get to see a lot of our, you know, fans more than once. Sometimes you only get to meet people once and it's very memorable, but what's really cool is when you, you meet someone and you see them again, maybe like 2 years later or a month later. There's a great story at a very early convention Ryan and I were at. I could be wrong, but I think it was Ken Daniels Fandom Fest, in Louisville. I want to say that's correct. I think the timeline, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. It doesn't matter in the story wise, but, there was a fan there. I usually don't mention, you know, fans' names, you know, because they don't want their story told. But she was there and she was pregnant and she was wearing a shirt that said Future Monster Squad fan with like an arrow pointed at her belly. Oh. And so what she wanted was a photo with me and Ryan, like pointing to the shirt. And so we did. And 5 years later, we're at another show and we get to meet the kid who's now five, oh, who likes the Monster Squad, and take a picture with him.
Oh, my God.
And who's now five. Cool. And so it's things like that, that this connection and the lasting power of fandom, you know, is very, very cool. You know, a lot of people will meet, you know, someone from a movie or a show that they like, or, you know, a recording artist, and, you know, get their CD signed or something. And, you know, that autograph doesn't, you know, it's like, oh, great, I got this signed by, you know, Rick Astley back in 89. And it doesn't matter. Usually with Monster Squad fan stuff, that stuff really holds, you know, a place in those people. They may have 1,000 other autographs, but, you know, if it's Ryan and I or Ashley or, you know, Fred or someone like that, that's Monster Squad, and they're in that core OG group, that means something to them. And you can tell that it's very genuine. And that's what's cool. So that's what kind of sticks in my mind.
I cry every time. But I know you mentioned this in your documentary, but what do you think of the word cult? Cult film. I mean, what?
Yeah, because, you know, I noticed that it was in the documentary. I think a lot of people were asked that question, but I don't remember if we got your answer specifically on, do you consider Monster Squad to be a cult film, and what actually is a cult film in your opinion? Because I remember there's a bunch of clips and a bunch of people answer, but I was like, I don't know if Andre, yeah, we got Andre's answer.
Well, that's one, on purpose, so I'm not saddled with an answer. But two, also, I'm not the focus of the documentary. I'm I'm there asking the questions to start the conversations, and just kind of, kind of paddling the boat as we go down this, kind of stream of kind of conversation of what is, what is fandom? What is, what is cult? And you're right. We got a lot of different answers. And, good friend of mine, professor and filmmaker herself, Rebecca McKendry, says, hey, you could ask five academics, what cult means, and you'll get five different answers. And she sets up that whole bit because we go through a, a whole chapter of it, and you get five different answers right away from professionals and from academics and from fans and even celebrities. It all means something different to whomever's answering that question and to whomever's answering that question at a certain point in time. But if you go by the definition, a movie that doesn't do well in the box office, but then finds an audience or an appreciation later, it has certainly attained a cult status and a following and a place. I think in the impact that the movie had, whether you realized it or not at the time, but definitely later when you look back at it and kind of analyze those, kind of layers of that onion there, it was a paradigm shift. It was a game changer. And so therefore I think that, in that regard, in the cult arena, it wasn't set out to be a weird movie. Look, because Ed Wood and John Waters, they set out to make cult movies, when they're thinking of the idea. That's their whole jag, right? Wasn't the case with Monster Squad, but it has turned into something that didn't do well only because the fans would not let it die and it meant something to them. So I think the Monster Squad jersey is up in the rafters of the cult arena, even though it wasn't originally meant to be there.
So, well, we have one final question that we ask everybody that we interview, and I think you're probably gonna, it may take some time to think about because I know you've done a lot of screenings and reunions, but the one thing that we ask every single person we interview on this podcast is, what is one thing that you can tell us about your experience working on Monster Squad that you've never told any other interviewer, publication, podcaster, or fan at a screening? One tidbit, that anything, if it could be about behind the scenes, maybe an Easter egg in the film, could be anything, as long as you've never mentioned it anywhere else.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Give me a second. You might have to clip, 10 seconds of silence later. probably I can't recall if I've actually mentioned it on air or, doing a podcast or not, but at the time I had a weird problem. I hadn't injured my toe, but I, for the entire shoot of Monster Squad, I had this giant, painful ingrown toenail. And it was just such this bad, bad experience. And it was just awful. It was infected. And I ended up having surgery on it after we shot Monster Squad. But I don't think a lot of people knew about that, I shot that entire movie with my toe hurting constantly.
Wow. No, that is, that definitely was not in the documentary. So.
No, it was not. It has no intrinsic value to sell a documentary. So
no, but
it was in the framework of the story.
But it's intrinsic value to us who love random.
I'm going
to
watch it differently now.
Now I'm going to watch that whole thing thinking, wow, he was
looking
in
at
pain.
Your face.
See what that yeah, is. No, I covered up well. I covered up
yeah,
well.
No, that's amazing.
Yeah, other than that, it's just, the stuff that, I don't know. If I think of a different one, I'll come back on and give it to you. But that's probably the most obscure.
No, we love it. We love it. Well, look, we so appreciate you taking the time to do this. Seriously, it's been such an honor for us to talk to you, and to take the time to actually go through all this and tell your stories and stuff. We're big fans, and we're just, we wish you and this movie and all of the impact it's had nothing but success. We hope it continues, forever. Thank you so much. Seriously. Thank you, Andre.
So
we really appreciate it. We'll keep you posted on to when the episode will come out. And Hope your back feels better.
It feels pretty good right now. Maybe this helped. It was good.
Good. No, we hope you've enjoyed this. We certainly have. And like I said, we wish you nothing but the best. So thank you so much.
Now, I appreciate you, inviting me, having me on. And please let me know. And we'll retweet and signal boost and connect as much as possible. And you know, hit me up again. We'll do it another time and talk about something else if you want to.
Definitely. Awesome. We appreciate it. Okay, well, take care. Have a great night.
All right, guys. Appreciate it. Take care.
Bye.
Good night. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Happy Horror Time. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, and many other platforms.
If you haven't already, please like and follow our Happy Horror Time page on Facebook. You can also follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Happy Horror Time to see all our glorious posts.
If you want to contact us, send us an email at happyhorrortime@gmail.com. Feel free to give us movie recommendations, interview suggestions, or just tell us how wrong we were about something.
We want to give a special thank you to our patrons for their support. If you'd like to be a patron, please visit patreon.com/happyhorrortime to sign up. Patrons get access to our monthly bonus episodes and exclusive content. We've actually built a pretty good sized library of bonus content by now, and there's much more to come.
I'm Tim Murdoch.
And I'm Matt Emmert. And we hope you've had a happy horror time.